This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Talks away. Brace yourselves, ladies and gentlemen, and please give a warm welcome to Hugh Lewis Jones.
Brace yourselves. Can you hear me okay? Right, we're going to start talking. I'm shouting for everyone else who's queuing up for Julia Bradbury or who's waiting for John Simpson. He's not here yet. He's here at 12 o'clock. I overheard something about a map. What was the question? Right, the date. Right, okay. Does anyone know the answer to the question? Okay, well, good. I might turn to you in just a second. A few things. I'm a bit of a map nerd, so this is just filler whilst a few more people fill in. Firstly, I suspect it's a Stanford's map, which means it's wildly inaccurate. When you look at maps, there are lots of telltales which help you place the date. So, for example, we've got a Pacific, which means for certain it's after Magellan. So we're not 16th century, it's not 1520. We've got a nibble of Tasmania. Perfect, so it's definitely post-Tasman, 1642. We've got Australia also, so obviously after Cook, so it's not 18th century. We're well into the 19th century. We're now beginning to think about distances between places. Crucial information on dating a 19th century, early 20th century map is usually hidden behind the screen or behind a door, or, most important of all, North Pole, South Pole, which are usually the giveaways, because if you know enough about Captain Scott, if you know enough about famous expeditions, gradually they're nibbling to the edge of the map, and it's almost like a chronology. So, if we were to have Franz Josef Land, which is farther north than Spitsbergen, we would know for certain it was after 1897. If we had a flag at the North Pole, we'd know possibly for certain it was after 1909. If we could see underneath the stage, we'd probably know it's after Scott, 1912. I would say it's early 20th century, 10 at a push. But Stanfords were notorious in the 1920s for recycling maps of the 1910s. So that's my rough guesstimate. And if it's not right, it doesn't really matter. The joy with maps is they change every time we look at them. They change each time we return to a map with new experience or new travels, the map will change a little bit. The most important takeaway before I begin is to make sure you fill your own maps with lots of great journeys. Can we start? Perfect. Right. Is this clicker working? Clicker's working. Fantastic. I have four... Can everyone hear me okay? I don't need to shout anymore, right? I have 40 minutes to give you 400 years worth of exploration history. Easy. Piece of cake. 40 minutes to tell you about a book. Who am I to tell you about a book? I'm a historian. I'm also a wilderness guide. This is me in the real world. In the virtual world, you can find me on Twitter if you like. But our journey has to move fast. So, in fact, coming up on the train, I tried to think where would be best to start this story. I'm a photographic historian as much as a photographer too. So we could begin the story nestled under the rings of Saturn in 2013. We could begin the story doing a drive-by of the planet Pluto, arguably the most distant photograph ever been taken and returned to the Earth. So a sketch, a digital photograph, sent back across the black void of space. An amazing image from the Cassini probe. The probe. So who am I? I'm that fella who holds the sign at the North Pole. That's basically what I do. Half of my year, I travel on polar voyages. The other half, I live in Cornwall. I make books for a sort of living. This was the high point of my career to date. I'd written books about the North Pole, but never been. I've now been three times. My mother, bless her, she doesn't really get excited when I go away on good expeditions. Her highlight... she's not yet here, in actual fact, but her highlight is when I rode a red sofa last year to talk about these two ships. Does anyone know these two ships? Erebus and Terra, she said. Absolutely right. You don't need to know anything about polar exploration history. Suffice to say, these two ships are the most important polar ships of all time. Why? They've just been discovered. Quite amazing. 170 years worth of searching, and they find these two ships frozen in time on the bottom of the sea floor.
It was a daring expedition led by famed explorer John Franklin. The goal, to find the fabled Northwest Passage. But Franklin and his ships vanished in the Arctic wilderness.
Disappeared off the face of the earth.
Now, after 160 years...
Oh my God.
Have these archaeologists finally caught sight of the Arctic ghost ship on Nova?
So that was the American version of a documentary. Oh my God, it was... It's very different to the Channel 4 version, which is obviously much more sedate. They were following in the footsteps of this man, Sir John Franklin. Why am I mentioning him? He's not even in the book. But he's really important for the story of journals, logbooks, sketchbooks, thinking and worrying about explorers. Because this man and 129 men, they disappear off the face of the map in 1845. They sail into that maze of islands in the Northwest Passage and disappear without a trace. The only written record, you see this sort of snow cairn, rock cairn, is discovered a few years later. A single sheet of paper, it's like about the size of an A4 piece that you put in your printer at home, with two messages, two status updates, if you like. The first, let's zoom in. So John Franklin commanding the expedition, all well. 1847, and just a few weeks later, a second update written on the same message, put in the cairn in the hope that someone would find it. A second message that says, look, on the 11th of June in 1847, John Franklin has died. The leader has died. The following year, the ships are abandoned, and the remaining men, the souls, 105 men, struggle to reach safety, walking south, dragging boats behind them, and they don't make it. Their skeletons still litter the islands in this part of the Northwest Passage. So a single piece of paper, single marks of ink on page have tremendous power. That single message, no notebook, no journal survives, but that single message has enabled a whole hagiography, a whole hero worship about this single explorer, John Franklin, a man who I'm still looking for. Does anyone know who this is? Of course. Anyone? Of course. It's Captain Scott. You're my star pupil. Fantastic. Okay, if you don't get any of the answers, this lovely madam will be taking questions at the end of this lecture. This is Captain Scott, arguably the most famous explorer, writer, journal keeper. Here he is in his hut in Cape Evans in Antarctica. You can visit. A number of the operators here could take you there. And you can sit and soak up the atmosphere. He's writing in his journal a few final letters home, in actual fact, before he begins his big journey south. Okay, we're 10 minutes in and I haven't really begun. At the end of this lecture, we'll know the end is in sight because this flag will pop up on the screen and all will be revealed why this is important. So that's my nod to know that I'm running over. How did I get here? Well, look, they very helpfully put a few books on the stage. Explorer Sketchbooks, which is the book I want to tell you about, is the fourth in a series of books that started with Everest. We did one on the first crossing of Antarctica, another on the first ascent, first crossing of the Arctic Ocean, and then this book here. Proudly on my kitchen table at home, an American edition, in actual fact, out next month. The English edition, I think, we've got piles of them. Right, they all have to go. I can't take them home on the train with me, so you have to buy them. I will sign them. I'll even draw in them if you want me to draw something in them. And this lovely lady will also be correcting all of my mistakes. So here we are. I asked my wife, she's a travel writer for The Guardian, incidentally, she's also co-author of this book, to give me a title for this lecture, and she decided that it's best to say, let's have a quick rummage behind the scenes. Maybe some of you want to know how we make a book like this, how, as a curator, I can gather stuff together. My preferred title would be A Quick Rummage in Old Men's Drawers, because most of my time, in truth, is spent, if I'm not in the field guiding expeditions, is in rummaging in drawers, finding documents and archival collections yet to go into national collections, and making books from them. It's amazing how much survives. This is an explorer, Alexander von Humboldt. Some of you might have read about him recently. He did one great journey in South America and then spent the rest of his life writing about it. And a lifetime devoted to a journey compiled in maps and charts and an ever-expanding library of knowledge. He writes a book called The Cosmos, a history of all of the knowledge in the known world. an ambitious book title. It took him his whole life to write it. Other examples, the first crossing of Antarctica. So I would go to a collection, pull everything out from the attic, rummage in drawers or gather things under the bed with a family's cooperation, and then make a book about the collection that survives. When I have too much books, 6 months of the year, I'll get some fresh air. So it's time we begin, and we begin with a bird. I've structured this haphazardly on the train. We're going to do it alphabetically. That sort of makes sense. It's the only way to manage this glorious archive. There are about 70 explorers in the book. I'm going to talk about maybe 20. This is not really an explorer in a conventional sense. He's a very famous bird artist. So I should say the name, John Audubon, of course, and the date will kind of give you a little flag. You might need your binoculars at the back to see it. What do you need to know about John Audubon? Well, he's widely thought of as America's finest ornithological artist, and this is one of his very earliest paintings of a bird. He's a young man. It's a robin through his window, an absolute beautiful image. His exploration was just beginning. Just a few years later, he's painting wonderful images like this. This is an osprey. Again, long before he's famous, for Audubon, his exploration begins simply by opening his eyes and applying paint to his page. John Aldjoe, this is the 1830s. Don't worry, you don't need to take notes. You just need to buy the book. So this chap is amazing. He sort of embarks on a grand tour of mountains that have yet been climbed. He's one of the first English people to climb Mount Mont Blanc and write a book about it. Not the first, but one of the first. He's certainly the first to write a book about Vesuvius. So in the 1830s, he writes a guidebook to volcanoes, the first sort of celebrity volcanologist, this guy, John Aldjoe, and there he is on the corner of the image, painting himself into the picture, showing his discoveries. And he would create images like this, absolutely magnificent infographic, if you like, each coloured line representing a phase of volcanic lava flow over time. A beautiful image in and of itself, I think, kind of timeless. Does anyone know who this is or where this is? Okay, it's difficult. Arguably the first ever depiction of the Victoria Falls. Who's been to the Victoria Falls? Okay, brilliant. I've never been, so I've only ever seen it in archives. Thomas Baines. It's in London. It's in the Royal Geographic Society. And this is a typical view for me. You'll see, long before I lost my watch in the Arctic, I would always take reference snaps of things in archives with my watch for scale, but also for colour balance. So when we were later creating books and using images, we could know for sure, or reasonably sure, both size and colour. So it's a helpful little hint. But in the archive in London, Thomas Baines is a traveller who travelled with Livingstone and other famous explorers, and immense first Western depictions of worlds never before been visited, certainly by Western travellers. Does anyone know where this is? I will safely wager a bet that no one has ever been there. This is the surface of the moon, drawn by this man, the only lunar artist. In fact, the only artist, an amazing boast, his name is Alan Bean, the only artist ever to draw from direct experience of another world. Quite phenomenal. Alan is an amazing man, still with us, one of the few moonwalkers still alive, full of incredible stories. NASA actually wouldn't let him use pastels in space. They were worried that all of the dust would get in his equipment. If you look on his wrist, he has a little sketchbook strapped to his cuff. And actually, he wasn't allowed to paint in it, although he did sketch in it. But it was full of all of these. It was a to-do list, the epic to-do list of things he has to do on the moon. Walk 5 meters, pick up rock, recheck bolt, relay message to Houston. All that sort of to-do list. Amazing. What's quite funny, and I didn't know this until I spoke to him. If you look inside, it's kind of pretty sort of unintelligible if you don't know the language. But his friends at Mission Control had also snuck in all sorts of pictures for him. Scribbles of Snoopy and pin-ups from Playboy with the message, "Don't forget, Alan, describe the protuberances." It's amazing. So when this poor guy is live to the world speaking to Houston Mission Control and flicking through his notebook, he's trying not to laugh. Brilliant. So as much as the horror and the peril and the danger of travel, no doubt, when you spend time to flick through original journals, you can find all sorts of humour. It's like the photographs that you'll take on your travels. You take a picture in the happy times, maybe the sun is setting or you're having a cocktail. Well, actually, explorers did the same too. All of their pictures aren't in perilous situations. For Thomas Baines, the guy who did that waterfall, you know, he did most of his painting at night as a hippo steak was sizzling on the fire, as the sun was setting, as the day's journey was done. You know, that was the time to create a lasting picture. I don't know what the neat segue is from a topless model to the bottom of the ocean. Here we are, we're on B, William Beebe. So in the 30s, obviously we hadn't got to the moon yet, we also hadn't got to the bottom of the ocean. So William Beebe, here he is, was the first man to go a mile deep in this bathysphere, this sort of steel ball bearing of a submarine, if you like. And he's lowered over the side of a ship. He relays his observations to the surface to a team of artists who are drawing creatures that obviously the world has never before seen. Amazing. Has anyone been here? Okay, this is the island of South Georgia. Does anyone know where that is? Of course. It's in Antarctica. This is the first ever chart of it by Captain Cook. Hurrah. An island today that most people visit because they want to pay homage to Shackleton. It's where Shackleton is buried. But Captain Cook in the 1770s is the first to go there. Amazing images, amazing sketches that all survive in London in the British Library. So all of his journals are there, his logbooks, his earliest maps. That happens to be Newfoundland. So it's a sketch, it's a map, it's an explorer learning his craft. Kind of an amazing document. But also, if you spend time, if you flick through the pages, you can find wonderful images that the artists who travelled with Cook did for him in his journals. So this is by an artist called William Hodges. You don't need to know the date. The only thing you need to know, it is the very first picture of an iceberg. I'm a geek, but I think that's pretty special. Wonderful on Cook's second voyage. Does anyone know whose journal this is? Okay, brilliant, Darwin. What a treat. Can you imagine holding this journal in your hands? The very first, possibly, I'm not a Darwin scholar, but it's certainly very early, the first inklings of his theory of evolution, the way species or a tree of intergenerational hereditary would be sort of drawn out. Quite an amazing little doodle in the margin of a sketchbook, a doodle, a single doodle that could change the world. Phenomenal discovery for all those who follow to find things like that in journals. And that's incidentally what his desk might have looked like, notorious for having an untidy desk. They say if you spend too much time tidying your desk, you're not spending enough time thinking or tidying or whatever. You won't know who this man is. I was hoping he was here. He's going to come shortly. He's an artist called Tony Foster. Possibly, I don't know, he's a great landscape artist. He's still alive. He lives in Cornwall, just up the road from me. Each journal he makes, he keeps a little notebook, fills it with discoveries. That's a clipping from an American newspaper. I've been lucky enough to travel with him both imaginatively and real time, and he goes to pretty wild places to create pictures. Back home in his studio, each of these little bags is a record of a journey. Each is a collection of objects or sensory, tactile things, notes, that he also incorporates into his artworks. So for Tony and for many other explorers, actually, their sketchbooks are living documents. They're things that are constantly referred to or torn from or used within artworks, within maps, within books that they may or may not create after their journeys. We're in Antarctica. We're on H. This is good. We're about there. Am I going too fast? Probably going a little fast. Can you all hear me too? It's quite noisy. I should just say the segue. With maps, you can work out where you are because of the little elements and symbols that have been discovered. When I came in this morning, I had to laugh. I've never been to this show. I didn't really know where I was. I didn't have a map, but you can tell where you are in the world. Like, as I entered the Himalayas, there were prayer flags everywhere. I knew I was passing through the Caribbean because even at 10 o'clock in the morning, people were drinking cocktails. As I came through Safari Land, everyone's wearing khaki. What's that all about? Ridiculous, but I digress. We're in Antarctica. The first ever images from East Antarctica, from an expedition with a guy called Mawson. His artist, Charles Harrison, created these pastel sketches. Amazing that they survive. Anyone who paints or draws with pastel, it's incredibly mobile material. So to think that he's painting these and drawing these images when the temperature is often well below zero is phenomenal in and of itself. That they survive 100 years, I think, is also incredible. So sketches in his private journals that show what it's like to go on a sledging trip, or show what it's like to boil up the fruitcake at Christmas over your primer stove with lashings of extra tobacco and rum and celebrate Christmas far off in the blank of the map that no one, even Stanford's, have yet to map. My favourite polar journal, an explorer called Sir Wally Herbert. Not many people have know Wally. I'm totally biased. He's an absolute legend. I'm biased because I'm married to his daughter. He's famous for a number of journeys. The first crossing of the Antarctic Peninsula, which is an amazing cartographic journey as much as a sledging epic. He also recreated for the very first time in the 60s the journeys of Scott and Shackleton, the first man to remap the routes through the mountains that Amundsen in particular took. Amundsen didn't have enough time to map the landscape. He was rushing to the pole and back. So Wally is there sketching above the Beardmore Glacier, and here are his journals. If you're going to remember Wally at all, he's remembered in England for his journey across the Arctic Ocean the first time. This is 1968, the first time ever that anyone had sledged across the Arctic Ocean, an achievement cast into the shadow of the moon at the time everyone is looking towards space. Man is just about to step on the moon for the first time. And that was Wally's great journey. It's the subject of this book and the subject of another lecture that I may yet give at another festival. H, my true hero, the first man to climb Everest. Obviously, anyone know? Of course you know, right. Sir Edmund Hillary, there's my watch again. And this is his journal in Auckland, 1953, the very first time that anyone had stepped foot on top of Everest. Some of you have probably climbed Everest. I've never climbed Everest, although I've been to the Himalayas many times. An amazing artifact. This is the opening from that blessed morning, May 29, 1953, as two men, Ed Hillary and Shep Tenzing Norgay, cut those steps up the final summit ridge. The whole world is watching. A young queen, Elizabeth, is about to be crowned. But all for these two men is nothing but silence. A few more steps, breathing heavy on their oxygen sets. And then at 11:30, that amazing morning, all of a sudden, they can see nothing but blue sky and mountains that fall away beneath their feet. Amazing. And you can read it all in his little journal. Amazing. Even just to hold it in my hands was a real privilege, actually, for me. So that's the famous photograph. I've talked a lot about these photographs in other books. There's no photograph of Ed Hillary on the top of Everest. The joke always was that Tenzing didn't know how to use a camera, and on Everest wasn't the moment to teach him how to use one. I actually asked Ed Hillary once, did it bother him that there was no photograph of him on top of Everest? Because, you know, I bet everyone who has climbed it since has a huge picture of themselves, probably above their mantelpiece or something. And Ed Hillary, this is honest truth, he turned to me and said, Hugh, why would it bother me? I was the first. Simple answer, the best answer. So from Everest, all of the climbers were sending letters home. If you look at their letters that still survive, they're full of amazing route maps and sketches, the first details of a legendary expedition. So I'm very lucky to have worked with and for one of these climbers, a man called George Lowe, a New Zealander. A tremendous man. These are his journals on my kitchen table. So not only did he or was a member of the first ascent of Everest, he was also the official photographer on the first crossing of Antarctica. This is 1958, and this is his journal. So his journals are full of sketches, how to pull your snow-cat tractor from a crevasse, but also full of the photographs, the strips of contact prints that he would develop in the field, in his dark room, in his hut over the winter, to try and work out a sequence of images to do his photo edit. Long before he could see them in the back of his camera, he was trying to edit his images so he knew that he would have shots that were usable for the books or the films or the TV stories that would envelop them when the world discovers they may or may not be successful for reaching the South Pole overland from the other side the most difficult way for the very first time in 1958. Amazing. Step back in time to the 19th century, not the South Pole, the North Pole, and we are trying to push our way through to the top of the world in a ship. Our ship is trapped, we're overwintering. Our head is in our hands because we're making our way through the third volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica. We've run out of things to read, perhaps. We haven't had a letter home for 6 months. This is a Sunday, so there's no alcohol for us tonight, so we have to wait till the following day. We'll get our rum ration, half a pint per man at 12 noon every day. That'll take the edge off. Maybe on a Saturday night, we'll get our ration of beer. 56 pints per man per week. Amazing. It's small beer, so it's watered down. It's water, so it's essentially the way they get vitamins too. It's full of yeast and all sorts of other delicious things that help them pass the horrors of a winter. Perhaps this is Sunday morning. With our hangovers, we return to the job in hand. Scientific observation in our snow observatory, measuring the magnetic needle, writing diligently into our sketchbooks. Important if you're an explorer. In case you never return home, your sketchbook will survive you. Like this sketchbook, in actual fact. This is from the 20s. An incredible attempt at Everest. Some of you might have heard of Mallory. Okay, so he's a climber who may have been the first to climb Everest. We don't know, from the north side. He disappears up the summit ridge, two tiny little specks disappearing into the clouds. He doesn't come down alive. But on that expedition, his companions are painting beautiful pictures, again, just on my kitchen table. A wonderful little sketch. There's Mallory there, the last image of a man who his family, who no one, in fact, would ever see alive again. A man who has become a legend for as much as what he might not have done as what he certainly did do in a tremendous life. The same, I should say, could be said for this man, Robert Peary. We're on the P's, so I better speed up. He might be the first man to get to the North Pole. We don't know for sure because, you know, we had no satellite GPS back then. We had no way of proving. How do you prove you've been to the North Pole in 1909? Well, you make a map, but that doesn't really prove anything because Stanford's will cut the top off it. So you take a photograph, but that also doesn't prove anything. Believe me, I've been there. The North Pole is flat, blank, and it looks like the last 800 miles. So you take photographs, you write a journal. But that also doesn't prove anything. That just proves you've written in your journal on that particular day. But Peary, having done loads of expeditions, having lost loads of toes, was keen, and his wife was particularly keen for him to do it on this final expedition so he could come home. 3 days before, he knows he's going to get there, or at least he knows he's going to tell the world he's got there, so he's designing the medal he's going to award himself. He's describing the selfie that he's going to take at the pole, making sure that his beard is frosted sufficiently that artists back at home will be able to make a heroic-looking picture. You think all of this posing is modern? No, it happened in 1909. But here's his journal for the pole. The pole at last, my ambition, ! The fact he was probably about 100 miles away doesn't really matter. Certainly didn't matter for his story. He got very close, which I think in 1909 is definitely good enough. By magic of this slideshow, I've jumped to the R's because I've only got 5 minutes left. My favourite polar explorer, not my father-in-law, certainly not Robert Peary, is this man, Rasmussen. A Dane, half Inuit in actual fact, grew up in Greenland. You can go on a cruise to his hometown of Ilulissat and see the house in which he was born. His journals are magnificent documents, not for the go somewhere and plant a flag kind of westernism, but for his sensitive understanding of indigenous peoples. So yes, he was an explorer in the 19th century and early 20th. He had to go places and make maps. But he went places and listened to the people who lived there and made the maps that they understood of the world in which they'd lived. So his journals are full of Inuit mind maps of the landscapes through which they travel. Maps not defined by latitudes and longitudes and trademarks and companies back at home, but inspired by the river systems through which they move through, the lakes that they understand, the numbers of headlands that they need to tick off in their minds as a winter sets in, as they're trying to paddle for the safety of home. the Inuit have maps carved from driftwood that they hold in their pockets so they can feel their way home, and they're waterproof. If you lose an Inuit map, over the side of your kayak, you can pick it up again and put it in your pocket. The most perfect kind of map. Stanford's note to self, let's make wooden maps next time. My wife always criticizes me that there aren't enough ladies in this lecture, and it's true there aren't. In the book, we've got loads of intrepid ladies. In truth, most of them, their surnames begin with ST, Freya Stark, Olivia Tong. And so I usually run out of time, classic chauvinist that I am, awful. But she's an amazing Victorian lady traveller, early 20th century traveller, who would do her exploring for the simple joy of travelling, opening her eyes, seeing the world. So her journals are full of the creatures that she met for the first time, full of tremendous beasties that terrified her as much as terrified her grandchildren when they could flick through her sketchbooks when she made it safely home. But it has always been this way. Explorers filled their journals with all sorts of terrors, real and imagined. This is the first image of the people of New Zealand, the Maori. Okay, it's a pretty unfair image, but it's the very first image, the very first time a Westerner, Abel Tasman, touches on that little bottom piece of Australia for the very first moment, creating the very first images of a landscape that we now know so well. I follow in his footsteps through his images because I don't speak 17th century Dutch or Latin. I can't analyze his journals with the level of scrutiny that I can with the others that I imagine. I follow in the footsteps of 19th century explorers in New Zealand. The coastlines have been charted, so now it's the task to do the mountains. And all of you probably know this kind of experience. You're going on treks, it's really cold in the morning, the soup was terrible, oh, yet another climb. Perhaps some of you have trekked in the Himalayas. It's always been this way for explorers. I have 5 minutes. We are going to have some questions, but 5 minutes to finish with two of my favorite explorers. They're all my favorite explorers. Captain Scott, some of you have heard about Captain Scott. For me, the highlight of this whole project was holding his journal in my hands. It's a sacred object because it's this object that he held in his hands as the light was going out in his candle, as the blizzard tore at his tent, as his friends were dying around him, as he wrote the final messages to his wife. His journal, you open it across the top, a message to my widow. He knows already that he's a man doomed to die. His entry from the North Pole, all the daydreams must go. He knows he's not got there first. He has 800 miles to walk to reach safety. He knows they're not going to do it. Even then, he fears for their survival. The final entry in March. It's desperately sad. We shall stick it out to the end, but I fear that it cannot be far. It seems a pity, but I do not think I can write more. Last entry. For God's sake, please look after our people. It's a tremendously touching document. 9 months later, it's discovered on his body. His papers are discovered. His tent is covered with snow. And his story is told for the first time. The world would not know of his achievement, of the sacrifice of his fellows, without that pencil-scribbled document. The final explorer, it's a penguin egg. This is a sketchbook of sorts of a journey, the worst journey in the world. Some of you might have know that book. All for the sake of a penguin egg that the museum didn't even want. Awful. Poor Edward Wilson, another man who died alongside Scott in that tent. A prolific artist, a man who loved penguins as much as icebergs. His final completed painting before he joined Scott on that last slow trudge to the south. Inscriptions, you can't see it, this screen doesn't do it justice. Inscriptions for paintings he would never complete. Scribbles of the backs of his friends as they're trudging in their line. The back of Scott or Captain Oates, I'm just going outside, I may be some time. The last images in scribbled pencil of men in these journals before they would never be seen alive again. So sketchbooks, in conclusion, are immensely important documents. There's no doom of gloom on your travels. I'm not saying you're going to die in your tent, fingers crossed. But the point is, if you want to share your story with others, please do use a journal as much as take photographs. And photographs are sketchbooks. That's okay. You know, I travel all over the world now just making images on my mobile phone to show my daughter when I get home. I promised we'd finish with a flag, and that's the flag. The moment when Edward Wilson knew that they hadn't made it for the first time to the South Pole. A flag planted by the Norwegians who have beaten them to it. The paw prints of husky dogs in the snow. Proof not only that the Norwegians have got to the South Pole, but proof that Scott and his men are second. Proof that those 800 miles to walk back in a blizzard are going to be the worst 800 miles of their life. And all of that comes from a simple sketch in a simple document. A few images to finish. We've got 5 minutes. I've travelled, been lucky enough to travel in their footsteps, travel with authors. You can go and hug a penguin. Well, you're not allowed to hug a penguin, but you can go and visit penguins if you like. Men and women from many nations are now living all season in the very places that Scott and Wilson and others fought and fell to bring back knowledge that can change the world. So this man, a man I've worked with, David Ainley, his daily observations of penguins, he's the guy who measures penguin poo and counts penguins. His observations on penguin breeding patterns have led to the preservation of the Ross Sea as an ocean site for conservation. So simple marks in his journal, he's a prolific journal keeper, can change the world. And that sounds like a cliched point in which to finish. But the power of marks, whether in writing or in photography or in the stories that you might tell, are very important. He's also not here, sadly. He's on a plane. But I said, look, give me a word of wisdom for everyone as they embark on their journeys. And he said three things, three simple things to remember when you go on your next expedition. Well, firstly, you need patience. That's really important. Patience to get the right companions, to get the right travel operator. Patience to wait for the weather to clear. So you need good weather. But the most important of all, well, other than a Stanford's map, other than my book, is a good pencil. Because you're nothing without a good pencil, without the record that you can leave behind for others who might follow. Thank you very much. That's it. Huzzah, leave it. So we have 5 minutes. You have 20 minutes before John Simpson. John, are you here yet? He's probably backstage drinking coffee. So we have 5 minutes for questions, if there are any questions. I would much, much, much rather you came and spoke to me at the Stanford signing stand. If you buy one book, I'll answer one question. If you buy all of my books, I'll get my daughter to send you a picture. How's about that? Any questions? Ideally, no questions, because I've got a few more pictures to show you. Right. Does anyone know who this artist is? Sit down, boy. I have 5 more minutes. Yeah. Right. Does anyone know who this... Okay, this is my daughter, clearly. I'm a doting father. I'm not an explorer. I'm a historian. We've established that. But it's my duty as a dad to try and make my daughter an explorer. That goes with the territory. So every time we travel, poor thing, she's got to do her homework. She's only six, but she's got to draw pictures. We go to Iceland and she draws lions. That's okay. It's fine. Her maps of Iceland are full of unicorns. That's okay. Perhaps they're there, I just can't see them. She's amazing. My wife, as I said, very lucky. She's the daughter of Wally Herbert, but she's also a very gifted travel writer. She also wrote this book. But I asked my daughter for what's the wisdom. So let's not listen to a penguin ecologist. They always make it up. Five-year-olds and six-year-olds tell the truth. What's the wisdom for going on a great journey? This is my second cliched ending, is that it's not about the destination, it's about the people you go with, right? So make sure you pick your companions well and draw them into your sketchbooks. Two images to finish. I'm going again to the North Pole next year. This was a map she drew for me when I went to the North Pole this year to help me find my way. And the thing about the North Pole is that actually all bets are off. All maps are pretty useless at the pole because there's nothing to start with other than the landscape that we can fill our stories with. Constantly moving chaos of broken ice and the stories that we tell. Topless mermaids, Laika the space dog, an Arunalai lifeboat and the Loch Ness monster. It's important. All of these things, my daughter, when she goes to the North Pole, will discover there. Last image. I actually started with this image. We sit under the rings of Saturn. Does anyone know what is amazing about this image? Of all of the images, photographic art, this one's not even in the book, it's in the next book. For me, this is the most important image for all of us right now. Listen up! The most important image right now. We are 800 million miles under the rings of Saturn. At that moment, the most distant image that's ever been created of our world. Our world. That little dot is us. It's not dirt on the screen. That little dot is us. Everything. Everything in this hall, all the crap that's going on in America, all of the horror that's going on everywhere, all of the joy that can be found on the edges of the map, all of that is going on in that little dot. Our shared world in troubled times. We share this world. We could do well to remember it. Thank you very much. That's it.